Healing crystals, skincare routines, knitting a sweater, fitting in jeans. With Katie and Sarah, no need to worry, you're on a lady journey.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Lady Journey.
Yeah, welcome to Lady Journey.
This is such a huge day for us because we have an actual chef and food person about town, Natasha Pickowitz. Natasha, yeah, welcome.
Thank you
so much for joining us.
I was going through your Instagram. I love your aesthetic.
Your aesthetic is gorgeous.
I think taking photos of food is hard.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, I think the most important thing is just to like not lean into anything that you don't know how to do.
Yeah.
And I just don't know real photography. So it's like you kind of are just figuring out what you can do within the parameters of like your own skills,
I guess.
Yeah.
It is a learning process. Well, taking you wouldn't think taking photos of food is hard.
Yeah.
It's but like shadow,
it's like a moon. You're like, why does it look good? But then when I take the photo, it's not coming out great.
Yeah. Well,
it's tiny.
I actually have in my apartment in Greenpoint, I have like a little backyard. I have like a little garden, which I'm very lucky to have. So I get all of this like beautiful natural light.
Oh, and that's the best way.
It's such a game changer. But whereas my kitchen has like no windows. So if I ever need to like shoot video while I'm cooking, it's always kind of a nightmare because you have to create something from nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're bringing in the giant floodlights to do a daytime look.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, I just read your scone recipe. It was white peony tea with blueberries. And I'm looking at the recipe. First of all, I love tea infusions with anything. Like my all-time favorite ice cream is the Earl Grey from... oh my gosh, why am I blanking on the name?
Van Leeuwen.
Van Leeuwen, thank you. Thank you. So I love tea infusions, but I've never seen this tea in anything. Can you tell us about a little the inspiration for the recipe?
Yeah, well, I also love a tea infusion. And actually in my cookbook, More Than Cake, I have an Earl Grey and chocolate mousse.
Oh, delicious.
I have like a chamomile pastry cream.
Mm.
I think that like baking is such a great opportunity to kind of build layers of flavor. So when you think about something that kind of like blossoms in temperature or in liquid, like it's such a great opportunity to kind of like add in more flavor where there might not be some.
Yeah.
So I think people already know this with things like coffee, but you know, I think tea is one of those things where there's like so much opportunity to kind of like pair it with spices, with fruit. And so with this, it's actually in collaboration with this women-owned company in Brooklyn called Donna Tea. I love them.
Oh, that sounds amazing.
So, Plug City. But
Donna Tea, check it out.
Yeah, I think like what you're seeing a lot with chefs, bakers, / like recipe developers like me who kind of like make money and share our work online and in ways like that, like finding a really good relationship with a brand for a product that you believe in is like a lot more lucrative than, you know, a lot of editorial is.
So
I try to make a good balance there. So I've been doing this like tea series.
Amazing. Yes.
Yeah. So we did like, I have more recipes in the pipeline with them. I did like a kind of like a lemon drizzle pound cake in the style of one, but with lemongrass tea.
Okay. Oh, yum.
So that's like also in my like Instagram, but you know, it's a way to kind of like take something that maybe feels familiar, but then kind of like bump it up in intensity and kind of like a unique note that you might not know.
Because I was wondering, that's always been the thing that blows my mind with, it's particularly baking.
Yes.
Because it is a precise science. Like cooking, you can just eye it. Mm-hmm. Baking, you can't.
I mean,
too much.
I would contend that. And I think I would say baking, like any kind of craft-based skill, you know, like knitting, ceramics, you know, painting, playing an instrument. It's the kind of things where once you learn the fundamentals, then that's when the fun can really begin.
Okay.
That's when you can kind of start to develop a personal identity, create your own repertoire, like break some rules, kind of be spontaneous, improvise. And I think that a lot of people have this preconceived notion in their head that baking is this very structured practice where you can't go off the map. But I think that the truth is that once you sort of understand the mechanics of how certain things work, like what does fat do in a cake? How much sugar do you need? Like how do these things interact in an oven? That's when you can really go back in and be like, I'm going to try this with olive oil. I'm going to try this with a nut flour. I'm going to try this steamed instead of baked. And I think that's where like kind of creativity, innovation, and personality can kind of come through.
Yes. So. Well, you're so creative with your stuff. I mean, we've looked at a lot of your work and I love like even the layer cakes that you do. I'm dying to get your cookbook, by the way. I'm like, I have to order it. But like the cakes that you've done, even the decor is something that you're really reimagining with the natural objects. Like what was your inspiration with that?
I mean, I think that like in a field that's kind of classical or traditional, like pastry and fine dining, there's this sort of very rigid set of expectations and conventions for in order to be a leader in this field, you must have gone to this school or worked in this kitchen or technically know how to do all these things. Yeah. And for me, like that wasn't my story. Like I didn't go to culinary school. I learned and, you know, sort of develop my love for pastry through working on the job, which was just a factor not being able to afford to go to culinary school. Yeah. And, but I think what you see comes out of that is instead of being like indoctrinated with this set of rules of how you think things should be, layer cakes must have sugar roses on them, be covered in fondant, etc. Like to me, I'm trying to make things that look beautiful, but taste great. That's the most important thing. Taste great. So I'm like stripping back all of this like extra sugar shit that I don't think is yummy.
Right? Yeah. Like, yeah. I don't like fondant.
People peel it back. You see photos of it's wedding so cakes crazy and people to me. Are like, it's like a skin that they're sort of peeling off the cake and like kind of pushing it to the side.
Yeah. And
like,
I don't need aesthetics if it's going to be. If we're just taking it's away all that stuff.
Yeah. And I think like when you're talking about making something that seems intimidating, like a layer cake at home, it's like, well, how can I encourage people to be creative in a way that isn't pulling sugar or tempering chocolate or any of these kind of like fussier kind of technique based things? I'm like, to me, it's, you know, playing around with herbs and like lettuces and flowers.
The natural elements.
So to me, that's like a practice I feel more connected to.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah, you're kind of like a renaissance, you know, in a way, kind of redoing. I think that, you know, maybe there are some similarities in the cooking world with stand-up also, especially being a woman in a male-dominated industry and maybe also not coming from, like, a lot of people that are stand-ups, you know, there isn't a school that you can go to from stand-up, so you're kind of coming in a way that you're self-learning. It's a lot of self-teaching, a lot of learning on the job. I don't know.
Well, like, a lot of trial and error, like, I dated a chef and he said culinary school, he thought it was a waste of time.
Yeah.
And he thought it would have been better for me to go like a back door of a restaurant and be like, like I will work as busser and work my way up and learn everything that you need me to do. And then move from restaurant to restaurant. Because I do agree with you. I think you can get indoctrinated in certain schoolings.
I mean, I think like a lot of kind of creative industries like comedy, writing, art, cooking, whatever. The unfortunate reality is like a lot of it is just driven by like your own privilege and who you know.
Yeah,
and I think that culinary school is an example of a certain kind of privilege. Like I just was not in a place to be $50,000 in debt.
Right.
Then there's this other sense of like, well, do you know, are you connected in the industry? Can people set you up in a trendy restaurant that'll provide you with more opportunities? There's also like a culture of, I'm not saying this is like open mics where you're like working for no money, but staging is a commonly accepted practice in cities like New York where you're getting like highly skilled labor for free from young people. And that's a certain kind of person who can afford to work and not get paid. Yeah. And
comedy's like, or improv theaters like that.
Yeah.
Like, that's why they have a diversity issue. Yeah. It's like, there's people that can't afford it.
Yeah, because it's like maybe men can go to open mics because they're not raising children in their household.
Right. Yeah.
I think it's a similar thing with kitchens where perhaps like men get to prioritize like their need to become like a star in a culinary practice. Whereas
it's 60
a woman
to 70 hours
might,
a week.
Yeah. So whenever I like meet someone who's a female chef like in a restaurant and they have kids or, you know, they're a single mom, I'm always like, wow, like how do you do it?
Wow.
Yeah, that's like the one where those are the people that you want to get mentored from, because you're like, that's a background that I can actually relate to.
I mean, that's like a whole other thing, because developing real, true mentorship in the culinary industry, especially if you're a woman, is like incredibly challenging. Mm. And I don't know a lot of people who have like developed and maintained those connections necessarily, because I think there's such a sense of like hustle and turnover, and like, you barely have time to take care of yourself, let alone like make sure this new person is like feels comfortable in what they're doing. So it's very demanding.
Wow. Now you had, as you're saying, you didn't go to culinary school. Can you tell us a little bit about your journey from your background to the chef world?
Perhaps not typical, but I studied English lit. My humanities major.
I love it. Yeah. Liberal arts.
But, you know, also it's like, I think that is kind of like a punchline in a certain way of like perhaps not being a very practical major. But I will say, now that I've published a cookbook, I found that, you know, it was precisely like my love of reading and my experience writing and that kind of like directly intersected with the stories that I wanted to tell in a cookbook and how I could write recipes. So it was very gratifying for me to like almost come full circle from this education that like perhaps my parents were like, why are you doing this if you're working in restaurants now? But, you know, I think it is makes a good argument for the case of humanities, just like applying to all kinds of fields like later on in life. But yeah, so I actually didn't really come into cooking until I was kind of like in my late 20s. I was living in Montreal. This was after having spent my 20s like wanting to be a music journalist. Oh. And I had applied to like, I wanted to go to grad school. Both my parents are in academia. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, a lot of times you model your own goals and ambitions after like what you grow up seeing and experiencing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So for me, I was like, yeah, like a PhD teaching, like that's what I saw. That's what I felt like was the ultimate realization of like loving literature or whatever. Applied to a PhD program in ethnomusicology of all things. Obviously didn't get in anywhere. That should not have been a surprise to me at 24 without a degree in from a music department even.
Yeah.
But that's the hubris of
same kind of where you're like, now looking back, you're like, no, it's kind of insane that I applied for a recording engineer when I don't even know music theory.
Exactly.
I had no guidance.
Yeah. And I'm like, but I'm interested in it.
But I'm like curious. I want to just do this.
Totally.
And be like, let's take another take, please.
Like, we're from the Legally Blonde era where you're like, but she got into law school at Harvard. Yeah. She just made a video.
Yeah. And I'm like, my essay was really good. Yeah. And I'm like, that wasn't enough. And they were like, no, you literally need 4 years of like, music theory background. Yeah. It's like playing classical piano when you're in middle school is like definitely not enough. But I think in the moment, like not having the kind of emotional intelligence to see that for what it was, I was like totally devastated. You know, I think like when you're that young and, you know, I was and still am like a kind of a competitive, ambitious person, like that kind of failure is really hard to reconcile. Mm-hmm. And you don't have a plan B. There's like this idea of like, I applied to 3 programs. I applied to like Princeton, like University of Chicago and McGill or something like that. And I was, and like, I didn't get anywhere. Like those programs accept like 2 people a year. It's insane. Yeah. But then after that, I kind of, you know, like got myself together. I needed a job. I was living in Canada. I was living there illegally. So I needed to find work that would pay me under the table. And, you know, historically, like that's restaurant work. And so I found a job in a restaurant, like kind of a luncheonette cafe that needed a baker. And I like obviously lied and said I had worked in a restaurant before when they asked me if I had.
That is a lady journey.
I'm a big proponent of lying on a resume.
I get fake it till you make it.
Absolutely. Like, I can't learn how to make a bread.
You're already dealing with like so many unspoken biases against you anyway that I'm like, and I knew I was like, I can figure this out. Like, I know I can do this. And I actually really like fell in love with like both the, you know, skill of baking and like learning how to do that, but then also the culture of working in a restaurant and, the people I worked with and feeding people. And that space was very unique in that it, well, it is a dépanneur, which is like a Quebecois bodega. Mm-hmm. So, but it had this like luncheonette in the back. It's called Dépanneur Le Pickup. And, you know, it's the kind of place where if you worked in construction or something, you would get like a breakfast sandwich there, but you could also buy like batteries and paper towels and like tampons.
Oh yeah,
like,
we love it.
Yeah,
it's a little bit of
like that next door.
Yeah,
you can get some like good food items that they cook for you.
Yeah, and then
your diapers.
Totally, and that area in Montreal, like back then, was like really exciting culturally because there were a lot of music studios in this kind of like outskirt. Now it's like much more developed and gentrified, but like, this was like 12, 13 years ago. It was where like Arcade Fire would record their music and they'd like bring in musicians and it had, and there was like definitely this like bohemian spirit of just like artists coming in to eat, like knocking elbows with, you know, the construction guys down the corner. And like, and so there was also this like incredible spirit in the space. Mm. And I started like booking small concerts in there and workshops, like canning, jam workshops, sausage making. I started doing dinners there. So I was baking, but I was like also doing all this other stuff for our neighborhood. And I think I saw how like those kind of things sort of ran parallel, intersected at times. And I wanted to do more of that.
Yes.
And so that was really kind of like the jumping off point.
Oh, that's amazing. That's amazing.
Was there a moment where you're like, I think I'm really good at this? I like cooking. But I do feel like, or baking, but I'm not, I know I'm not good. And I don't have that thing in me to keep going forward and to discover, but you're like, I liked finding a recipe and making it. And that's probably as far as I'll go.
Yes. Yeah. I love baking myself, but I'm in the role of like appreciating, I think. And that's, and I love
also
that
important.
Also.
Yes. But
I feel like you need a sense of discovery or like experimenting.
100%. First of all, like live for that feeling. I do feel that sometimes. And that was definitely hard fought. You know, I worked in restaurants in New York City where the de facto kind of way that you would get feedback from a boss was never like, you're doing a great job, but was like, you're fucking lucky you work here. Like you step it up. So there was never this sense of like, am I doing a good job? That was mostly coming from my peers, getting feedback from my team. It wasn't really coming from like a boss figure. But like that feeling that you're describing, like I write about explicitly in the introduction to my cookbook, I kind of call that like the pride chip, where when you make something and it turns out, or in my case, like working in restaurants and getting feedback from a guest or a customer of being like, holy shit, that was like mind blowing. That's when you're like, I did that.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, as much as we can like cultivate that feeling in our lives through like little things that we do for ourselves is like a really important thing to, for me, it's like something that is why I'm like baking, is to kind of like check back in with that feeling. And like, I think it's really like empowering to like be good at something too, or not just like be good at something objectively, but that great feeling that you get where you take a bite or you look at your handiwork and I'm not making the best cakes out there, but I know that the way that I make them gives me a sense of pride. So
100%. I feel like when, as you're a woman and you're going through your career, you're getting into your 30s and your 40s, the feeling of competency is so valuable of like, oh, you know,
I deserve to be here.
Yeah, I deserve to be here. We're so encouraged to have that imposter syndrome, you know, or even if you do feel competent, you're almost encouraged by society to be like, oh me, like, no, that's nothing.
Totally.
Those are my little cakes. Like, you know, it's dog shit. You know?
I catch my girlfriends doing stuff like that all the time. Mm-hmm. I think that like our friendship is expressed through like holding each other accountable for like gassing each other up a bit.
Yes.
And so I think it's something that's easier to see in other people you love than perhaps like in yourself.
Oh yeah.
So I like, that's definitely like, I don't, and I think also the other like thing that I struggle with in our society in the US, like with the way, you know, being number one, getting awards, all that shit is like not important, but we chase after it anyway.
Yeah, and then I don't think it fulfills you. And I actually think sometimes if that's what you're going for, I don't think you're homogenous. Going to be,
yeah, it's like everything's the same, trying to be the best, but it's like, but what about the experimental things going on?
Yeah, you're not going to have creative success that way. Like, I want to have, I like, that's why I like going up in places where I don't feel like I have to kill.
Yes.
All the time. I like a low threshold like a so I can experiment.
I completely agree with that. And I think that process of experimentation, failure, mistakes is actually like the most important part of like my creative process. It's not just like bangers. It's like, you know, learning about my palette and like what works, what doesn't work, and like trying to build on that to get to something that does feel like a breakthrough. Like if everything was amazing, then nothing would feel like that special. But yes. I think that it's that process of kind of striking it rich, you know, with something that you're kind of like, can't, like I was so excited to share that scone recipe because like in my recipe testing, I'm not somebody that goes back to my own work to eat it a lot. Like I don't actually really have a sweet tooth. And I think that's because I'm like tasting sugar all the time. I don't crave it.
That's really fascinating.
Yeah.
I love that.
But like, I'm like, I want a piece of pizza. I want something salty. I want like something, whatever. It's not sweet. But with that recipe, I was like, I realized that I kept kind of doubling back to the kitchen to like get another morsel to have it after whatever. And I'm like, wow, this recipe is like something that I'm like, really love. So that is always a really nice feeling too.
Oh, well, I love scones. So I got to tell you, I feel like scones are actually, for me, it's been an acquired taste. Like growing up, I was never, you want like a cookie or something. When I got into my 30s, for some reason, I'm like, scones.
Yeah.
Well, I just got to indulge in an Irish soda bread. I just got one from Fairway, which I think is like the giant scone, you know, the Irish.
I think that like, you know, with certain baked goods, scone, which is not even that American of a thing, like what we think of as a scone in the US is maybe more like a drop biscuit, whereas like a scone in the UK is like, you know, they're very like fastidious about what constitutes like scone, and it has to be like a certain thing, and you know, can't have like that recipe that I developed would be like, they would be like, that's blueberries in it, like you Yankees. But like, no, I think that, you know, something like that, like you've probably had a million bad scones, you know, crumbly, dry, tough, dense, whatever. So I think part also of my work is kind of like getting people to change their minds about things that they thought they didn't like. So
that's you hear that about scones, like a dry scone. I'm like, if you're eating a good scone, it's not dry. The denseness of the butter and the cream is just, It's the best.
Yeah. Well, this is where I don't feel like I've had a cake in the last few years that I'm like, that's amazing. And the reason why I think I'm getting more into like shortcakes and stuff is like, I like the saltiness. And I find a lot of cakes are, I don't know, somebody I saw said this was about American desserts, and I think I might believe them. I find them to be too sweet without the flavor.
I knew you were going to say that. Yeah. And I completely agree.
Maddening to me that you cannot get even a basic sheet cake sometimes. And you're like, this is just sugar.
Totally. And I think that like a lot of, I think that it's like people have a hard time understanding the role sugar plays in dessert actually. And sugar as an ingredient actually like dulls flavor and sensation, and it mutes certain flavors. So if you have something that's too sweet, you have a hard time discerning like a great flour or high quality chocolate, or that's when people are like bringing in things like salt to kind of make it feel more balanced. But the truth is that, you know, I definitely gravitate towards desserts that are not too sweet. I think that, you know, like East Asian style layer cakes, like from Korea or China, that are not sweet at all, actually are like more delicious to me. And so I'm kind of like, it's, for me, it's all about like building layering flavor. So sugar is kind of like a last resort, or sugar is like salt in that it can enhance the flavor of certain things to a point. And then at which point it kind of like topples over and it ruins it. So, you know, it's like ice cream, or, you know, it can add like a certain kind of texture that is really important, but like it requires like developing a certain kind of palate too, I think. And that's where like the work of tasting kind of comes in.
Now, did you have a recipe that you kind of either tweaked or came up with, or you're like, here we are. Here I am.
I mean, I mean, every recipe in the book, I definitely felt that way. Like some of them were years long in the making.
Because it has to be, right? Yeah. I mean, your life is going on, so it's got to be trial and error. And baking is like 2 hours a lot of the time.
Yeah. At least. Yeah. Definitely 2 hours. But I think there, one of the things I felt nervous about with writing a cookbook is how final it feels as an object. And, you know, I'm someone where my recipes are liquid, they're fluid, mm-hmm. like they're constantly, I'm constantly tweaking, developing, making changes. So there was this feeling I had of like, oh, once it's published and in print, that's it. Like they're going to be done. But I'm kind of like trying to go easy with myself on that and kind of allow myself to be like, you know what? This is just a snapshot of like the recipes I was thinking about in 2023, but you know, those things can change and I'm not going to like be too anxious about that. But absolutely. I mean, when you're working in a restaurant, like I think in the best restaurants you go to, there's this sense of not just like replicating something over and over again, but being present, this idea of being present or engaging with something so that you can continue, so the dish can continue to evolve and change.
Wow, that's huge.
And I think really, really great restaurants do that.
Yeah.
And they're not like, we, like it's so, it's really very male to be like, we figured it out. We've got the best thing. Yeah. There's no more room for improvement.
Yeah.
And we did it.
Oh
like,
my God.
I would say no, I've never felt that. I think that like, do I feel like I have the best chocolate chip cookie recipe? Yeah, I stand by that. But at the same time, I know that all of my work will continue to change and it's not a static thing. So I think like kind of both of those things are true.
Oh, the evolution. I mean,
it is true because there's a cookbook author who has a well-known YouTube show. I'm kind of beginning to think, I don't think we have the same taste buds.
Ooh.
Well, I know that I think she likes things a lot more saltier than I do. And so that's always kind of fascinating. You're like, oh, this might be not the aesthetic that I was looking for.
Yeah. The palate's different.
I think a great cookbook author or chef that's sharing recipes with you will also kind of empower you to respond to their work in ways that still fit your sensibility. And maybe in certain cases they aren't right. Like they're like things spicier than you, or there's a textural thing. But with stuff like salt, like, you know, that's the kind of thing where taste as you go, and then you kind of get a sense of like what you like and what's right for you. Because you'll never grow to like things that are too salty. Like I think that's not an aspirational thing.
Putting like anchovy salt paste and tomato sauce.
I know who you're talking about.
You probably do. I wasn't aware of anchovy paste being in a lot of stuff until I was at, and I liked the sauce. But then there are other things that she was pairing it with, or like anchovies with, and I'm like, oh, good God.
Yeah.
That's insane. Like an olive? I was like, that's so salty for me.
That's true. I think, again, like I'm a Libra, so I'm really into balance. But I think balance is really important in dessert for sure, because you're talking about so many rich and decadent textures and flavors, like, you know, dairy and sugar and all that. But, you know, I have a recipe in my book that's an olive oil cake.
Oh,
we all love olive oil cake. Yeah. But it is garnished with capers that have been fried in olive oil.
Oh, that sounds
and
great.
And I think that, like, I know you're not supposed to do this, but I was reading like reviews of the book on Amazon and like, or like Goodreads or something. And one of the reviews was like, oh, I wanted to make the olive oil cake, but like capers on it. My kids wouldn't like that. And I'm like, well, in the head note for the recipe, I talk about what happens when you fry capers in olive oil, which is the thing that is intense to us for something like capers, or in certain cases olives, is the brine that they're sort of like coated in. Mm-hmm. And if you rinse that off and then, you know, kind of fry them in a bit of olive oil, something amazing happens to capers, which is they get really like nutty and sweet, and they still have like a savoriness to them, but it turns out like they're this like wonderful kind of salty finish to a typically sweet cake.
She's not trying it.
Give it a try.
Like, I have a friend that I was like, she's like, I don't like anchovies, and I'm like, you actually will be surprised how much stuff fits in. Like it's in Gardettos that I didn't know about, and you're like, you probably eat the shit out of those.
I mean, I have this conversation with my mom like all the time, where she will be like, I don't like mayonnaise, because in her mind, it's like something that's like fatty and not good for you. But I'm like, it's literally just oil emulsified into eggs.
Yeah.
Like, I promise it's nothing more than that. Like, you like all those things separately. And when they're like come together into this, you know, like spread, like it looks different. And it's white now because you've blown all this air into it. Well, you know, it's, whatever.
Yeah.
So I think like there is this sense of like confronting our own, you know, fixed ideas of like things we think that we don't like. And yeah. I've had that journey too. Like, you know, I've eaten out a lot and tried a lot of things. And that's what's truly exciting about being a person who likes to try food is that you get the opportunity to surprise yourself and find out what you like. Like, that's there's the nothing part. Better.
Yeah. Oh, no. Okay. Here's a fun question. So we love travel on the show. If you were traveling to an American city, or we can say also Hawaii, Puerto Rico, Where are you going for a food trip?
I would say, I mean, politics aside, I really haven't eaten that much food in Texas.
Okay.
And I think that I've always really wanted to go to Houston.
That's where I'm from.
Really? Yeah. Oh my gosh.
It's a great food city.
I have like a lot of friends who are Vietnamese, and there's like a really big like Vietnamese immigrant population there. And I think like through knowing those people, they've shared with me like how international of a food city that it is, and how many
Houston proper is very diverse.
Yeah,
the suburbs you're not gonna get that.
Sure, yeah. But I'm definitely like I am definitely curious to try all the things there, and that's been on my list for a while. But
that's exciting. Yeah. That's a good one. I was just there actually, and one day I had like a pizza, I had enchiladas, I had juice. I was like, oh, it was great. I had a vicious stomach ache, and the next day I was like, I think I'm good. I'm just eating crackers now.
Yeah,
but I'm actually planning a trip to Hawaii, which I'm really excited about, and I'm doing like, you know, my save Google things of like, okay, I'm getting the shaved ice here, I'm getting the malasadas, and I'm like, just cannot wait to go on food journey of just like tasting everything.
That's exciting.
So exciting. But one thing I want to ask you for sure before we have plenty of time still, but give us the journey of you putting your book together. What was that like?
Yeah.
These recipes, some of you had been working on for years. Were you doing a lot of testing?
Yeah. I mean, I will say that it was my first cookbook, and publishing in the US is like one of these mainstream like industries that's actually very like kind of traditional, and it's sort of done a very specific way. Like, I don't know a lot about like how TV gets made or like whatever, but I imagine there's similar kind of like gatekeeping stuff that happens. It for like beginning with who even gets to write books. Like,
it's also arbitrary and antiquated sometimes. Meaning like, why does it? And you're like, I don't know, just because.
Yeah,
like that forever.
You know,
and you're like, why? I don't get it.
I think like, you know, when you think about how few like publishers there are, main big ones in the US that publish like everything that we read. And I think with cookbooks, like, because it's such a unique kind of text, it's technical, but it's also personal. And I think also in the last 10 to 15 years, there's been like a huge surge around cookbooks as these like vehicles for personal storytelling, talking about trauma as it relates to food, talking about your dead grandmother, talking about, you know, your family, your kids, like whatever, your health journey. Like, the cookbooks now have become personal in a way that I collect a lot of cookbooks. The cookbooks I love from like the 60s, 70s, 80s, like it's not about the author. Like, you have to look to find the author. Like, that really didn't start until like Martha Stewart in the 80s. And when you're seeing this kind of like,
it almost seems comical icon. To be I need a cookbook for my childhood trauma. Yeah. Like, that's wild to me.
It's like the podcast documentary where the person is like weaving themselves into the murder that they're solving. It's like, I don't care about you, Jan.
Well, I mean, like, I really go back and forth on this because like when I scrutinize my own cookbook collection, like there are texts I have that are not about personal storytelling at all. And then there are some where you're like, well, you know, 20 years ago, this kind of person never would have been given a chance to tell their story. And I think that there's like more diversity in terms of like authorship and cookbooks that perhaps there's ever been. But the flip side of that is like the metrics of like who becomes an author has really changed a lot because of social media and the internet. So like I was acutely aware of that as like somebody who not on TikTok, didn't have 100,000 followers on Instagram or whatever, like being like, that is a roadblock to me getting a book deal, to me getting a book deal, to me getting as much of a book deal as like, you know, a TikToker with like millions of followers.
Yeah.
Like when you, like, that's what I think could make a person feel cynical about the process is, you know, what are publishers looking for when they're wanting to buy books from authors. But I will say that like the experience for me was like really incredible. And it began with like the relationship I have with my book agent. And I think like now that I have this book out, I am like talking, I think the most important thing you can do if you want to write a cookbook is talking to other authors. Mm. And like, I'm sure that's true. Like, you know, if you know you're a comedian, like knowing, talking to your peers and like figuring out how other people do it, because that to me was like the most revealing thing in terms of like help and being like, oh, I'm not alone thinking about it this way. Like that's actually normal and I'm not an idiot.
Destigmatizing the learning process.
That's but like liberty of, you can stand on the shoulders of giants, meaning like I know personally, artistically, I'll be like, I really like what they did there.
Yeah,
I'm gonna do that.
Oh my gosh, of course. Yeah. I mean, yeah, like
appropriation. Yeah. Never hurt anybody.
I mean, the mood boards I made, like, that's actually like critical to the process. Where I was like, I was going to the library every day. I was going through my own books. I was going to McNally Jackson and looking at literally every single book in the cookbook section.
Wow.
Pulling out, not even if they spoke to me or not, just like pulling out every book because they were way too long, and just looking and seeing how it was done. Like, you know, taking photos of stuff that I liked and, you know, filing all these like little things away for how to like synthesize that into something that's
Me. I love this in the film of you, the montage.
But yeah, I mean, it was like, it was really, you know, in the I mean this in a good way, but it was like an excruciating process. It's so, it was so hard. And there was, it really was like, you know, I wrote the book. I think a lot of chefs, you know, will pair up with an author, a writer to, you know, kind of like do the, create the book together, but I really wanted to write it myself. You know, obviously developed and tested all the recipes myself. I food styled every single photo in the book I made myself. You know, and there's a lot that I learned, like authors finance their own photo shoots. That came out of my advance.
Oh, that's so crazy.
And that was something my agent,
disillusioning.
Yeah, it was like something that my agent coached me through. Like she would be like, okay, try not to spend more than this percentage of your advance on these expenses so you can like live. And she really like guided me through that process of, you know, getting the best talent that I could afford and also like using that sense of like DIY kind of scrappiness to my advantage. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, actually that ended up making a book that felt like more personal and real for me. Like we shot the book in my parents' house in their garage. We were like using props of, there's like props that we were finding around the house. And, you know, I think that actually sometimes when you have constraints that like forces you to kind of like work better or smarter, like more creatively.
Oh, absolutely. Like, always have restrictions.
I didn't have 60 grand to rent marble surfaces for photos. So we were like in the driveway on the bumper of my mom's truck, like on patio furniture and finding cool textures. And like, you know, I think like that it's something I'm really proud of, like how we use that to our advantage as like a creative prompt rather than like something that blocked us.
Yeah.
But yeah, the whole, all in all, the process really took like, the book came out almost a year ago. It came out April 2023. Okay. So I sold the book, to give you a sense of the timeline. I sold the book in July 2020.
Okay.
Took two months.
Intense time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had lost my job as like the executive pastry chef for this restaurant group in New York, which was like, I mean, obviously like the period was so challenging for everybody.
Yeah.
It was really tough for me. Like I was living by myself. I was single. I, you know, I went from working 80 hours a week to just being like, like, what the fuck is going on? Yeah, and just being like cut loose in this way that felt like so brutal. And I had like a lot of like anger from that like situation. And my agent was like, no rush, but like whenever you're ready, like maybe we can hammer out this book proposal while you are sitting on all this time. And she was absolutely right. Like, you know, it took me 2 months to write this proposal. It was like very hard. But then I had this like roadmap, but then we sold the book. I got to work. The book went to the printer summer 2022. So yeah, it was a long time, but at the time it was like, I need more time.
Yeah. Such a story of triumph of 2020 being such an intense time. And then
especially for restaurant workers.
Being devastated amongst that, but then coming out of it was something amazing.
Yeah. But it's like what you were talking about earlier with this, like, you know, not getting this job at 24 or whatever. It's like at the time I like losing my job, I was like, again, no plan B. Like, what am I going to do? Yeah. Like, this is who I am. I have no other identity. This is everything. But then I was like, actually, now I have time to write this book. I never would have had time to do that working in restaurants. So, you need a little perspective to see that, like, those opportunities are coming out of these moments of, like, grief and like heartbreak and like all this stuff ending is when the new stuff starts. So.
Yes. Well, More Than Cake, everyone, please order it. I can't wait to get it.
Yes.
Now, what do you think for spring? Like springtime in New York, I always love, like I was talking about, like the Irish soda bread. Mm-hmm. I love a hot cross bun. Mm. Like, do you have any pastries that you're on the lookout for in New York City around springtime?
I mean, we just wrapped like the Lunar New Year. So I think that's a really good time to kind of get like,
I love the moon cakes and
specific little pastries and all the little treats that kind of come with the holiday season. I think obviously with spring, like everyone is just looking forward to seeing like fruit in bakes again. For me, it's like, you know, you go to enough like New York City bakeries and you kind of start seeing like green garlic and ramps and like savory things. And then you start seeing like rhubarb popping up in places. And, you know, I go to the farmer's market a lot in Union Square, and you can kind of get a sense of like you've seen those things pop up on restaurant menus. I think that like winter obviously is the season perhaps for baking, but as we go into spring, like you're starting to see like lighter things too. And that's also really exciting.
Yeah. Spring is my last hurrah for baking, because I never bake in the summer with the heat. It's like, I'm just a salad person.
Yeah.
Do you mostly shop at the farmer's market? Is that where you get your groceries?
I to be totally honest, like, it's harder in the winter, I think. I'll still go maybe like once a week or once every 2 weeks. But, you know, from like November until May, really, it's like rutabagas and turnips and like overwintered stuff and greenhouse stuff. And you're more limited in that sense. But I'm a big fan of, in New York City, one of the reasons why I love New York, of like I have a million little places for each thing I like to get. So one place where I get everything. I have like my fish person and my meat person and my cheese place and where I get my like eggs.
I feel like Greenpoint's a great place for that too. There's the lovely old school butcher shops and that kind of thing.
Exactly. Like, I mean, yeah, in Greenpoint, like I can walk to, there's the Greenpoint Fish Co. There's the Meat Hook, is kind of like East Williamsburg. I live on the same street as Archestratus, which is a bookstore. But they also sell like some of the best, most high quality, like kind of fridge staples and Italian pantry stuff that you can find anywhere. So I'm getting like vinegars and pastas and dried beans and stuff like that from her. My apartment is really little, so I'm rarely doing like a big shop because I just don't have space for it. I fantasize about that someday, but for now it's like I went to stop by the store this morning and I got sprouts and tampons and coffee.
The essentials.
Yeah, it's just all like little bit. Every day I'm probably grocery shopping.
I started doing Fresh Direct a little since I had the baby. That I was like, it's just easier. I can't do a big Loat, and I can't tell if I'm saving money. I just don't buy meat because I find it too pricey from there.
Yeah. Yeah. I like, yeah, there's some places like I'll get, I like going to the H Mart in, they say like, they call it Long Island City, but I feel like it's Woodside. That is the new location that just opened, and mm-hmm. they'll do deliver through like Instacart. That's like, sometimes I'll get like deliveries from them. That's yeah. really fast. Because it's, you know, there are some places where you're like, if I had a car, I would do this better.
Yeah. Yeah. But I know yeah. that's my fantasy. Just having, I have a mini fridge. That's my reality that I'm living in. Yeah. And it's actually great because it just forces me. I just buy stuff fresh.
Yeah.
I don't have, but yeah, I know I'm think of Costco, you know, I'm like, I just want to load up.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Now, do you predict any, do you do food trend predictions?
Oh yes.
Like,
I love it.
Always so fascinating to me where I'm like, why is cauliflower everywhere now?
Yes. Like, yeah. It was like the bean moment last year.
A bean moment
like we got into beans.
Yeah.
We got into beans. Now, what do you think?
I mean, I think a lot of that is kind of like you're kind of talking about sort of the COVID ripple effect too, where people are sort of getting in touch with like, it's like the sourdough bread is like the dried beans to me, where people have a little more time. And so they're doing more things from scratch, or they're being more frugal because they're not working and they're buying things like cauliflower or like
the tinned fish era.
Yeah. And I think like for me, like I personally like try to circle away from trends because I don't really like, I think the most important thing is to just have your own personal taste.
Yeah.
And that's the coolest the thing that you can do. And like, that's just what I personally strive to do. But like, obviously people ask me about trends and stuff all the time. And I can tell you, pastry wise, one of the cooler things that I'm seeing is ingredients that I perhaps would have relegated to like fine dining restaurants, like French restaurants, Korean, whatever. I'm starting to see in like home bakes, like on social media and stuff like that. And part of that is like some of those previously esoteric ingredients are more accessible to home bakers. Mm-hmm. And part of it is also like our widening interest and like curiosity for ingredients beyond our like known culture. Mm-hmm. So like passion fruit is one that I think about a lot.
Yeah.
I grew up in San Diego where it grows like wheat there, but until very recently, I would say I only really saw passion fruit like expressed in baking, like in restaurants. But you know, there was a big story in the New Yorker about like, I'm seeing passion fruit everywhere. Like passion fruit's a trend. And I'm like, wow, it's kind of crazy when you see something that you've known your whole life as like being reported as a trend.
Yeah.
But I think like along those lines, like passion fruit, yuzu, which is kind of like a citrus from Japan, that's sort of similar to lime. You know, things like one thing I've really seen take off lately with pastry is like black sesame paste.
Oh, yeah.
Which, you know, I think like it was like 8 years ago, people were like trying tahini for the first time and like learning it. And I think like people are like less nuts because of allergies and shit like that. And so now they're like, ooh, seeds. So white sesame paste, like tahini, like it seems real mainstream now. Mm-hmm. But I think black sesame paste, which is something you see more in Chinese and Japanese cooking, that's starting to pop up in like buttercreams, in cakes, in cookies and shortbreads. And like, that's awesome to me because I'm like, yes, this is so awesome. Like, it's one of my favorite flavors. It's like peanut butter, you know, it's like fancy peanut butter. So,
oh, I love it. I love like the reimagining of the different traditions. It's like you're saying, like, you know, the cultural fusions that we're getting to explore through food. It's really exciting.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Well, we do have to wrap up because of time, but Natasha, I want to say thank you so much for coming on. You were an amazing guest.
Yeah, thank you.
So delightful, so wise, and you brought so much to the table. Everybody, please check out Natasha. Where can they follow and find you online?
My website is Natasha-Pickowitz, and then my Instagram handle is just Natasha Pickowitz. My book is called More Than Cake. Obviously, like, you can get it through your favorite indie bookstore or online. But yeah, thank you guys so much for having me.
Yes, everybody, please like and subscribe to Lady Journey and enjoy your life.
Yeah, Lady Journey.